Okay, and welcome back. Talking with Harry Cooper tonight about World War II, a side of it that very few Americans know anything about. They just think of those evil Nazis. Remember, the Germans never used that term. That was concocted by MI6 or GCHQ in the UK. It's a disparaging term. And they played the gamut from A to Z in terms of public relations, disparagement, smearing, painting them out as demonic, evil. So never mind Chairman Mao Zedong killed 60 to 80 million. Never mind Uncle Joe, our ally, killed up to 100 million. No one really knows. Never mind all that. And there was never any talk, by the way, and this, I'm not talking for Harry, I'm just speaking from my own research, which goes back a long time. There was never any talk about the big H until the mid-60s, late-60s. That's when it kind of was launched as an enterprise. There's much more to the story than the average person will ever know. And I remember recently that Elie Wiesel was in Auschwitz, and there was another guy in Auschwitz who knew Elie Wiesel really well. They're in there together in that labor camp working. They made him take 3 showers a day to try to keep them healthy so they wouldn't get typhus and lice infections. And he said the Elie Wiesel, who has been well known, he passed away a year or two ago, was not the Elie Wiesel from Auschwitz. It wasn't the same guy. So that was a concoction, too. Anyway, World War II bears scant resemblance in Western history books to what really happened. We'll just leave it at that. But these pictures are fascinating, and it helps us understand there were so many German Americans here, and there were so many, Charles Lindbergh would lead many of them, so many huge rallies to keep America out of the war in Europe against Germany. The Americans didn't want anything to do with it. And then, of course, FDR tricked us into Pearl Harbor and forced us into the war in Europe, and you know the rest. Most of you are pretty well informed. All right, Harry, any comments?
Then we'll go on. You're doing fine.
Okay.
And you were correct about how we got tricked into the war. The Germans had a monitoring station up in Canada, Montreal or Quebec, I can't remember which, but they intercepted the call from Churchill to Roosevelt on a scramble phone, telling Roosevelt that the Japanese were coming on the 8th of December, which to them it was the 8th of December because of the international date line. It was the 7th of December for us. And that's why all the top brass was out of touch on Sunday, the 7th of December. And in my opinion, and from what some of our guys who were there at the time have deduced, those carriers were not out to sea by accident. They were out to sea so they wouldn't get hit.
Of course. Absolutely.
But, you know, World War II was because Hitler wanted to kill all the Jews and rule the world. That's the easy way out.
Please. Never mind the 250 to 400 plus thousand German Jews who enlisted in the German military to fight for their homes and their country. Never mind
that. I've been in cemeteries in Germany that's only Jewish soldiers who died fighting for Germany. And I had a friend, Helmut Schmuckel, Jewish guy. He was commander of U-802. And there was another guy I didn't know, Rosenbaum, Helmut Rosenbaum. Mm-hmm. Doesn't get much more Jewish than that. He commanded another U-boat, and he sank a British aircraft carrier. And Erhard Milch, 100% Jewish, he rebuilt the Luftwaffe. But
so,
we're not supposed to know that.
You're not supposed to know that. It's just, that's why we spend time with the remarkable Harry Cooper, going over a little bit of history. For those of you who are older, you remember as children some of it. For you younger people who are trying to get a handle on reality, The first casualty is the truth. It's gone. And the winners write the story. And God in heaven, do they write fiction. Oh, it's just incredible.
Yeah.
Just incredible. All right. Here's a letter now. Dear Harry, let me read this real quick. Dear Harry, ever since I joined Shark Hunters, I intended to write this letter just to let you know who I am. I like to keep it short and to the point. I was born at Frankfurt, Maine, Germany on November 21, 1917, entered the Kriegsmarine on January 1, 1938, after basic training and other things.
Funkschule means radio training, radio school. Funk is radio.
I knew that. sort of. After 5 months in the KM Funkstelle, Kiel Tannenberg,
it's a town.
How'd I do?
Oh, you're doing ducky.
Oh, good. Ducky, that's another German term.
yeah.
I transferred on April 1st, 1939 to U-17. U-boat
One with Flotilla. A dot behind it means the first.
Got it. Okay. After three war patrols, U-17 was assigned to...
Combat school.
That's it. Following something, he went to U-563. Blom and Voss
was a big shipyard.
Yeah. After commissioning and following in tests, etc., we joined... you finish this up. You flotilla at Brest.
First flotilla at Brest in France. In May 1943, I had to leave U-563 because of problems in both ears. Yeah, if they had ear problems, they couldn't be on submarines anymore because of the pressure changes.
Uh-huh.
And then he mentions KTB, that's our magazine number 83. And he says, I went to the 25th U-boat flotilla. Now, the 22nd, 23rd, 24th, and 25th U-boat flotillas were all training flotillas, okay? So he went there at Danzig and later at Liebau, from here to Oberfunkmeister School. Oberfunkmeister means chief petty officer radio.
Okay.
And he goes on, after a short assignment to Aviso Hela, I was assigned to Agru Front, which was the main combat thrust of the U-boats, where I served to the end of the war. He was a German U-boat radio man, and mm-hmm. he came to the U.S., became a U.S. citizen after the war. His P.S., I enjoy reading the KTB, that's our magazine, very much. It sure brings back memories. You get the KTB every month, and if your listeners would like the current issue, all they have to do is send me an email, sharkhunters@sharkhunters.com, and say they heard the show, and I'll email them the most current magazine.
Very good. Very nice. Very nice letter. And you see, that's a nice thing about what you've done. You have really extended a hand of comradeship to people you never necessarily will meet or did meet or can't meet. And a lot of them are gone now, but they appreciated it so much. And that was very special. Now look at the next picture. Look at these young men in there. Huh? How many per boat on average?
U-18, which is a type 2.
Uh-huh.
And this is
how many on board?
They carry a crew of 25, four officers and 21 enlisted petty officers, whatever. And this is where the enlisted men sleep. They had hammocks. And if they were on a war patrol, mm-hmm. they had torpedoes on the deck covered over with plywood. And the guys would just roll out blanket roll and sleep on top of the torpedoes until they were able to. Now, that would be on the Type 7s and Type 9s. These Type 2 boats only carried two reloads plus three in the forward tubes, and that's it. They'd go out, sink some ships, win the war, and come back, as one of the skippers told me. But, you know, here they are, having their grub.
Yeah.
Plenty of room, right?
Right. And I'm not in any way taking anything away from any of our American boys who were involved. Or how about our American women who flew the bombers? A lot of them flew long distance with them to deliver them to various locations.
Those were the wasps.
Yeah, we had on both sides.
Everybody who served honorably in that war is a warrior. You know, they're not horrible people. It doesn't matter what flag flew over them. They did their job. And the only ones who were really vicious were the Japanese. But that's another whole story. I'll never own a Japanese car.
They were a whole different mindset, no doubt.
Yeah.
And ask any American who fought in the Pacific.
And some of the historians just kind of gloss over it. Well, that's the Bushido mentality, so that's okay. No, it ain't okay. Torturing and butchering people, but that's another whole story. We'll save that for another radio show.
Right. Okay.
Don't get me off on my soapbox here.
No. You stay set. Number 10.
Number 10.
Two boats,
these are
side by side.
Yeah, side by side, type 2 B boats. And I put this up here to show the conning tower emblems. On the one on the right side, you'll see is an alligator with an umbrella crushed in its jaws. And I think that's a reference to Chamberlain.
Churchill.
Chamberlain, the guy called the Umbrella Man.
Correct. That's right.
And also the boat on the left. That's a caricature of Chamberlain.
Now, see the two items above the caricature and look over on the other conning tower. You see the same two items.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. I don't know what those are.
So they made them into bombs or above the pig. They just used them.
Yeah, whatever.
Right.
I don't know what that is. Artistic license.
Or as Inspector Clouseau would say, artistic license. Number 20.
No, it's number 11. That's U-20.
Sorry, U-20. Number 11.
That's one of the type 2 boats, and we'll talk more about that on the next picture, but this one you can see is sunk. This is not a war grave because there were six boats in the 30th Flotilla over there in the Black Sea at Costanza. One was destroyed by Soviet bombing. The other five, as the Red Army was closing in on them, they just headed across the Black Sea for Turkey. And when they ran out of fuel, they just opened the sea cocks and let them sink. And this is U-20. It's one of the Type 2s. If you look right underneath the 2, you'll see one of the torpedo tubes.
What would you, if you were able to bring up a non-war grave U-boat, what type would you like?
I'd rather a 7, because that was...
They were over here. The 2s didn't come across the Atlantic, did they?
That's correct. That's correct. The 2s didn't have the range.
Right.
The 7s were over here. The 9s were over here. The 9D2s, the 10Bs, 14s, they had all come over here. There are some of them still here, but unfortunately, they're all war graves on this side.
Yeah.
Except there were a couple of, like U-234, they were expended after the war. In other words, they were just left floating out there while an American submarine torpedoed them for target practice. They ain't a whole lot left after some gets hit by a torpedo.
All right. Image number 12. What do we got?
Number 12.
Boats in dry dock?
Nope.
Are they?
You'll notice
they're
not very long. Say again?
What happened?
They cut them. They cut them in half.
They split, and then they shipped them. Those are on barges then.
You got it. These are the ones that went to the 30th Flotilla down at Costanza. And the one on the left side, U-23, that was the boat of my good friend Otto Kretschmer. And they floated these things down the Donau River, which once it crossed the border into Austria, it was called the Danube. And it went all the way down to Costanza, Romania. They put the boats back together and used them in the Black Sea. And the skipper of U-23, the last one, is Rudolf Arendt, A-R-E-N-D-T. He's a member of Shark Hunters. He's still alive. 96 years old, I think he is now. And he's still very sharp mentally. I don't know what shape he's in physically, but mentally he's sharp. And
can we get him on the program?
I don't know. I'd have to send me an email to remind me, because I'm old and feeble. You got to remind me. But we'll find out. His English is excellent. So anyhow, these six boats, U-9, U-19, 20, 23, 25, I can't remember the rest of them, but there were six of them. Like I say, one got destroyed by Soviet bombing. The other five went over to the Turkish coast. They are non-war graves, and they are in shallow water. So who knows?
Right. Do you know where one is near you off the east coast of Florida? Is there anything in your area?
What that is not, Florida?
Yeah, that's non-war grave. How many boats went down off there?
No boats were, no German U-boats were sunk off Florida shores at all.
Okay.
I know there are rumors, and when we first moved here, and I'd be at a local dive shop, oh, God, the guy'd tell me, oh, there's a Nazi
U-boat. Harry? Yeah, Nazi U-boat out there. It's only 20 miles offshore. Yeah.
Couldn't be German. Had to be Nazi. And it was always full of gold. But you can't go there because the Navy has draped a net over it, and the Coast Guard will chase you away if you try to dive it. And I'd ask him, why would the Navy put a steel net over it? Oh, to make the coral grow so you can't get aboard and take the gold. And I asked him, well, why didn't the Navy take the gold? Duh. And then I tell him, hey, look, I'm an officer with the U.S. Coast Guard Auxiliary, and believe me, they won't chase us off if we dive. And I got $1,500 in the bank in a separate account, and I got 3,200 PSI in my tanks. You put me on a German submarine in Florida waters, and you got $1,500 in your pocket. Well, then they admit that they didn't really dive it, but they heard from Aunt Matilda's pool boy, who heard a drunk in a bar once.
Uh-huh.
But he assured me that some old-timer saw that submarine go down. Yeah, well, but submarines do that. They come back up again somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the files, every single German U-boat that was sent to operate in Florida waters came home. So they can't be sunk here if they is home. There's a couple of dozen U-boats sunk off the American East Coast, but not in Florida waters. There's one off the Mississippi passes, too, and I'm still having trouble with this. I've got pictures of it on the bottom. It's allegedly 5,000 feet deep in the Gulf of Mexico.
Oh, there's a huge, what you call it, a crevice? Or anyway, there's
trench?
A depression. Trench,
yeah, apparently
off Cuba.
Because this thing's
off
in it.
Northwestern Cuba, and they have sent deep dive submersibles down there. And the claim is that there is a whole city down there, a grid layout of streets, buildings, everything. Did you ever see that? That's true.
I understand. I haven't seen that one, but off of the island of Andros, to the west of Andros, there's supposed to be a pyramid down 700, 800 feet down. This was all done by a guy named Manson Valentine, who lived in Fort Lauderdale, who was a buddy of Clark McClellan, God rest him, and he also found what was called the Bimini Road, or the Bimini Wall, which was two rows of 16-foot by 16-foot stone
big
blocks
stone
side by side.
Blocks. Yeah.
Right.
They look like
and
a
I
road.
Know that's, yeah.
Yeah.
The road or the wall. It depends on how deep those blocks go. I know it was there because I dived those things. I mean, I snorkeled them. They start out about 6 feet deep, and then they go straight west and follow the curve of the bottom. And I don't know how far they go because I didn't have tanks. All I had was my snorkel. I was there. And the damnedest thing, the water is like your bathtub in the Bahamas. It's crystal clear and warm, warm, warm. But you swim over these blocks, and the water gets icy cold. I don't know why, but it happened. I was there. I didn't read about it or hear about it. I did it. I was there.
So the tops of these 16-foot blocks, 16 by 16, something like that,
and
what Harry is saying is if they go deep, like 20 feet deep, they were a wall. If they're shallow, like 3 feet maybe, It might have been a road. We don't
right.
know.
And Dr. Manson Valentine said he estimated they were 16 feet deep as well. Now, I don't know. I didn't dig up the ocean, but...
Well, that's like the... Harry, that's like the Easter Island. The heads in Easter Island. They found out that every damn one of them had a body under it. Just
that head that's 20 feet tall had about a 60-foot body down below it under the ground.
Yeah.
In the sand or whatever, yeah. And don't forget... The Bimini Road, that comes off of North Bimini, and yet South Bimini is where Juan Ponce de Leon believed he would find the Fountain of Youth. Not any old place somewhere to the west, but he believed South Bimini is where that was supposed to be. And right. Ernest Hemingway's brother, Leicester, did a lot of research there, too. And unfortunately... They must have had a strange gene in their gene pool because Lester Hemingway shot himself in the head, too, just like Ernest did, just like their father did.
Yeah. Well,
Lester used his father's gun to shoot himself, his pistol.
Well, all right. A little bit morose there, but... All right. Hold on, ladies and gentlemen, and we'll be right back with our walkthrough history with Harry and all of you good people in just a few. Hang on. Okay, and welcome back. Just to keep you up to date on a tech level, I run the audio from where I am to the network, which is in Pennsylvania, Harry's in Florida, through an iPad. Wonderful machine. Except when I forget to make sure that it's plugged in properly the night before, so it's fully charged. And I'm running at 6%, which... might get me to the top of the hour here. We'll see. I plug it in during the breaks and bring it back up. So I'm running, really, I run down to like 2%, and then it pumps back up to 6, maybe 7. Anyway, it's a good little machine. It's the operator error that caused the problem. All right. So, but we're okay. We got 6%, and we got 20 minutes. Let's see what happens. Okay, Apple, you're being tested. So what we are is two gentlemen strolling through the wonderful work of Harry Cooper, his newest book, first of a number of them coming out. And I hope you're with us. Go to guests and pull up Harry's name, the only name in guests tonight, and we'll take a look at the pictures together. So we're on photo number 12, and we'll close that out and open up photo number 13. Which is another logo on a conning tower with a running light up to the right of it. And that is, now wait a minute, let me look at this. Hold on.
See if you can figure it out.
Would that be the symbol of the British government? And then it's got darts in its butt?
That is correct. That is correct. I'm glad you're carrying the show because I'm in the kitchen pouring my coffee right now. But yeah, that's the British Lion, and the Germans with their U-boats.
The darts are submarines, torpedoes, of course.
Yeah, right. They caricaturized the enemy as Churchill. A couple of them had Chamberlain, but They use that because they...
Well, I remember, look, the logos on the BF-109s, for example, Adolf Galland's.
Yeah.
Adolf Galland had a pick. Look, this is the 1940s. They loved Walt Disney over there.
Yep.
And he loved Mickey Mouse, and they liked Donald Duck. He had Mickey Mouse on the outside of his cockpit on his BF-109.
Right. He was a member of Shark Hunters.
Well, I told you the story. I sent him VHS cassettes of 1930s vintage Disney Mickey Mouse cartoons. And his wife, I sent them to him, and his wife wrote me back a wonderful letter saying he just watches them over and he loves them. So yeah. That was kind of neat.
She was a nice lady. I corresponded with her after he died. He died on the operating table, heart surgery. But he was an ass kicker. He really was. He was a brave guy. 103 kills. But yeah. He was the youngest general they had. I think 30, 31 years old. And he helped rebuild the Argentine Air Force after the war.
Yep. Okay. Adolf Galland.
Yep.
Very interesting people.
The fighter general.
General of the fighter forces. And if only he quit. When Hitler would not give him the Messerschmitt 232 and configure it to be an air superiority fighter, Adolf Galland said, "I quit," and he walked out. That is why in 1943-44 they finally got the program turned around to reconfigure the Messerschmitt 262 into an air superiority combat fighter, not a Schnell bomber, to fly over England, drop a couple bombs, and fly back real quick. Hitler just blew it. He had the damn thing in 1941. He didn't understand the concept of air superiority. Galland did. So Galland eventually quit, and he came back when Hitler relented.
So many instances where you can say shoulda, coulda, woulda on all sides. And in your personal life, too. Shoulda, coulda, woulda.
Not me.
That's why Monday morning quarterbacking is the best.
I've never second-guessed myself.
Okay. You're ahead of me there. I've looked back on a few
things. No, I always make mistakes. It's all right.
Yeah.
No reason to worry. Not always.
I thought I made a mistake once, but I was misinformed.
Well, I can believe that. All right. Number 15. Is that where we are?
14.
All right. Number 14.
This is the unglamorous side of U-boat warfare. This is all the stuff you got to load on before you take off on a patrol. There's food, there's cans of this, that, and the other thing, cans of food, baskets of food, all sorts of stuff you got to put on.
Right. Call the ship's stores.
Yeah, that's what the grunts do. Now we can go to 25.
25 is a kick. That's just a funny one. Look at the conning tower on that one.
Yeah. This is...
That's a great white shark mouth.
Right. They like to be fierce. Remember I told you that U-1 was not a Type 1, but a Type 2. Well, now here we have U-25. That was a Type 1, the first of the Type 1s. They only made two of them, U-25 and U-26, because nobody liked them. They were not easily handled. They would sometimes dive when they just felt like it, or they would pop to the surface when nobody expected it. So, and this is dockside. Then if you look at photo 16, that's the other Type 1 boat, U-26. One of our members was a crewman on this boat, and he said he didn't like it.
Now, so look at the serrated impact device at the bow.
Net cutter.
Okay.
And you'll notice that 26 is on the conning tower. You look back there and you can see the number on the conning tower. Anytime you see a U-boat with the number on it, it's pre-war.
Interesting. Got it.
Yeah, because once the war started, they had to take the numbers off so that the enemy wouldn't know which boat was where, but yet they could put any emblem they wanted on it. So where's the anonymity?
Got it. All right. Number 17.
That's U-26 under air attack. It did get sunk. I'm not sure if this was the attack that sunk it, but it did get sunk in combat. were just ill-handling boats, and nobody liked them.
So that boat, people would say, why didn't it just dive? It takes time to dive. You get jumped by a bomber with ordnance, and you got trouble.
Yeah, that's true. And now the bigger boats, like the Type 1s, Type 9s, it took them a bit, maybe 30 seconds to get down. A Type 7, from the time they yelled alarm dive to the time they were at periscope depth, was about 15 seconds. American submarines, 25 and 30 seconds. But American submarines operated way out in the middle of nowhere, so they had a good chance to see the airplanes coming. And the U.S. submarines had good air search radar. And they had lookouts way up in the periscope shears. The Germans didn't have lookouts up there. They were just standing on the at the bridge. And sometimes on the American boats, they had something called a high scope watch. And Joe Burgess, one of our members who's now passed on, he rode an American submarine, and he explained what high scope was. In other words, he sat in the conning tower with the periscope extended up as high as it would go. And this, they're running on the surface now. And a periscope up as high as it would go, and the guy would be watching through the periscope. So he had one hell of a view over the horizon.
That's smart.
Yeah, it's smart, except if the boat is rolling. And remember, these things are round-bottomed, so they rolled, and you're watching through the scope, and you're sitting down just a little above sea level, but your eyes are like 40 feet in the air. And Joe said they had to rotate the guys out every 15 minutes because you're just getting sick to your stomach.
Well, I can't even imagine being in a long tube like that underwater rolling. No.
Yeah, those guys were tough.
Would U-26 have been firing at that bomber with its deck gun?
Well, not with the deck gun, but with the anti-aircraft gun.
If
they had gotten up there to man the gun, and it depend on what the armament was. They had all sorts of different options, anywhere from a single 20-millimeter to two twin-mount 20-millimeters, or the Fierlinge, the four-barreled, which is two up and two down.
That's pretty ferocious, isn't it? The four-barrel?
Yeah, but the four-barrel, they were constantly... they had to keep cleaning these things because they run underwater most of the time, and you get corrosion, so they had a lot of jamming. Excuse me. And then they also had a 37-millimeter anti-aircraft. But, you know, it's only... And the U-boats had shot down Allied aircraft, but the Allied aircraft also sank a lot of submarines. So the airborne guys had a much bigger advantage.
All right. Okay, let's jump up to number... We got to keep moving here. Number 18...
Number 18, this
U-27.
Is the one I told you.
Yeah?
Yeah, they took a picture of U-27 through the porthole, and the submarine is traveling from your left to your right. The bow is to your right. And just forward of the conning tower, you see the deck gun. That is, let's see, that would be a four-incher, a cannon. But just abaft the conning tower, you'll see... That's where the 37-millimeter is, an aircraft. And this, by the time the Wakasta, now the Wakasta wasn't damaged because they checked to make sure it wasn't carrying war supplies and let it go on. By the time Wakasta got to port, got the photos developed and published in the magazine, U-27 was already sunk.
Wow. All hands?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Almost every one of them went down with all hands, most of them.
Number 19.
19. You can see the victim of U-29 sinking. And the reason I've got this one up there, you see the circle? This is a 7A, Type 7A, and it's different from any other submarine Germany had. That is the stern tube on a 7A. It was above the waterline. whereas all the other Type 7s, it was below the waterline and fired between the rudders and the props.
Huh. How did that work out, being above the waterline?
I don't know. They only made 10 of those boats.
Mm-hmm.
And then they went to the 7B and then to the 7C, which was, they made tons of those 7Cs. And then the 7C40.
Down to 2%, Harry. 2%.
Uh-oh.
It gets, we got, I might make it. Probably be on 00. Todd will have to call me back. If I drop off, Todd, just ring me back. Okay, let's go to number 20.
Which was U-30. And this is a special boat in my book here. You see the yellow circle. That was their conning tower emblem. It was a little puppy dog. And they got that because there was a puppy dog came to the dock and grabbed one of the ends of the lighter lines and was running down the dock until suddenly, you know, the line pulled taut and the dog flipped over. So they adopted the dog on board the boat. This was the first boat. We call it the first. Why? It was the first one on station when war began. It was the first one to fire a torpedo. They blew up a rock they thought was a cruiser. It was the first one to sink a ship. They sank the Athena, which was a big disaster because it was a liner and they weren't supposed to sink it. And it was the first one into a captured French port. They sailed into Lorient while the buildings were still burning. And this was the boat that our friend Georg Hugel was on. He was the radio operator. And then later on, half the crew took over U-110, and he went with Limp. That's Limp leaning on the railing just above right of that circle. That's Limp with the white cap.
Wow. Remarkable.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's see.
31. Or 21, I'm sorry. That's peacetime. And the skipper there on the left, see the white cap and the 2.5 rings on his sleeve. His rank is Captain Lieutenant. And they had some photographers on board while they were in port doing a photo shot. And then if you click on over to...
When you say peacetime, this before the war started?
Yes. Because when you click over to the next photo, 22, you'll see the number is on the conning tower, and that is the magazine that the photo shoot went into, Die Wehrmacht, which means the armed forces. And from the Reichskriegsministerium, in other words, the Reich War Ministry.
Okay. All right, let's duck in number 23, U-31. What's going
on
with
that? Yeah,
that's
the same boat. Unfortunately, it didn't do so well after a bombing attack, kind of over on its side in the dry dock.
So the bomb went off while the boat was in dry dock and
knocked it over.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to help you out here because I know you're about to go out of battery.
All right. Todd will call me up.
Okay.
Let's see what I got. Hold on. Todd, you better ring me up. Down to 1%. I'll do the phone for the last 4 minutes here. It's okay. Todd's probably gone out for dinner.
At this hour?
God. If you're there, Todd, call me. I have to go to phone now. All right, he's calling. I predict the phone will ring here momentarily. Number 24.
24. This was still peacetime. You see the number on the conning towers, U-32.
Sir?
And you see those up and down stripes, the black and white stripe. This boat,
right.
and of course the families were coming down to say goodbye to the guys because they were heading out. And prior to the actual war, Germany was helping Franco in Spain. And this was one of the boats going there on the so-called peacekeeping, even though some of the U-boats were sinking communist ships in there. We're the ones who broke the story about Operation Ursula 25 years ago, thanks to Peter Hansen. But those up and down black stripes, they had them on any submarine they sent into Spanish waters.
Okay. kind of like the stripes they put on the planes for D-Day.
D-Day,
three
absolutely.
Stripes on each wing.
On the fuselage, too.
Right. Okay, so number 25, we're in Ursula.
Ursula was the operation, and you see on this boat, which is U-33, you see the vertical stripes on the conning tower.
Sure, I got them.
And they're in a Spanish port.
What is that type, what? That's got to be
seven. That's a seven with the
kind of a coastal boat.
Narrow bow. Well, they started 700 tons, and then later mods went up to 1,000 tons. But these are long, narrow boats, but you see the big saddle tanks on the side.
Mm-hmm.
That's indicative of the sevens. And Operation Ursula was named for Ursula Hessler, who was, before she married Gunter Hessler, was Ursula Dönitz. Admiral Dönitz's daughter, and she was a member until her passing.
Nice. Okay, next.
Yeah, number 26, you see the same boat in port, and I've circled the stripes.
Stripes, yeah.
Yeah, that's...
The stripes, well, the U-34 has stripes too, right next to it on the left.
Exactly, because they were there as part of the peacekeepers. However, one of them early on sank the Spanish, what the hell was it, C-3, I think it was a Spanish ship.
Mm-hmm.
The submarine.
Right. All right. Number
27.
Now, there's quite an image. In fact, there's two images there. They decked out their conning tower.
Yeah, I think they want to let you know what they have in mind. Stepping on Churchill's head by an elephant.
Yeah. Yeah.
As I say, they personalized the war a bit.
Hey, all the better. It's the truth. Churchill was... Well, anyway, okay.
He was a hero. The history books say so.
Yeah, right. Churchill, who couldn't keep his clothes on, Churchill,
yeah,
who drank a fifth of scotch every day, who would take
That's
his clothes completely off and mix company to walk around, he's a sick man. And there were probably four or five doubles of Churchill.
Boy, that taking the clothes off part would get me to barf and then leave the room in a hurry.
They've covered that up pretty well. He was really a despicable human being. He was that. Okay.
Who knows?
Now this is fascinating. 1939, October 15th, Life magazine, cover story on a U-boat. And there's the famous flag up there.
And as I
what
say,
type
before,
boat would this be?
Before the U.S. got into the war, the Germans were treated by the press. They were treated just the same as the Brits, the French. They were just another combatant. It was only after the U.S. got into the war that they suddenly became horrible
the monsters.
Nazis. Yeah. Amazing how those things happen.
All right.
That's U-35.
Let's duck one more in here. Let's get to number
29,
the
U-35. Yeah. If you remember the movie Down Periscope, oh, Jesus, I'm getting a text message here. Sorry. In the movie Down Periscope, where they decided to sneak into harbor by hovering underneath a huge tanker so their sonar image wouldn't come up. Well, this one, U-35, was doing the same thing under the battleship Graf Spee. In like 1938, I think it was, and they got a little too close, and that's what happens when the propellers of a 35,000-ton warship go through
deck.
Your submarine.
Wow!
Look at the
you can see the propeller impact as
slashes.
It worked its way along the top of the boat. Chop, 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 chop.
Can you imagine being inside that submarine?
No.
What the hell?
Then how did they manage the surface?
Go through the pressure hull. This is just the outer hull. And the outer hull is only like about a 16th or an 8th of an inch thick. But the pressure hull, of course, is an inch or better thick, and it didn't get that far down. And if you look at the next picture, 30, you see the conning tower, too. It's got number 35 on it because it's pre-war, and it pretty well beat the tar out of the conning tower, too.
I ate that right up. Fascinating.
Yeah.
Great pictures, just amazing pictures. All right, hold on a minute. We'll pause and come back with much more ahead as we continue this walk through history. Any comment you make, sir, before we go?
No, I'm just having fun, and it's great we're able to show some of these really, really rare photos that people aren't going to see anywhere else except here or in our book.
And the book is available now, and we'll tell them more about that.
Right, all there'll be a special offer.
Very good. Harry will personally deliver the book. All right, back in a minute. Hold on.